70 years with KBS World Radio, 70 years of Global Korea. Throughout the year, we celebrate the 70th anniversary of KBS World Radio with the voices of our listeners from all over the world.
저는 미국 동부 버지니아 살고 있는 뉴정희.
I'm Yoo Jung-hee from Eastern Virginia. When I first moved to the United States, I really wanted to listen to radio from back home. I managed to get a shortwave radio and have been tuning in ever since for the past 35 years. Both my husband and I are big fans of KBS World Radio. We listen together when we're both off work on the weekends. My husband really, really likes KBS World Radio. Sometimes if I'm still in bed when the program starts, he would bring the radio right next to my ear to wake me up, urging me to listen with him. My brothers back home are always surprised by how updated I am with news from Korea. My Korean friends here also ask me all the time about what's going on in Korea right now. Congratulations on the 70th anniversary. KBS World Radio, thank you, and I love you.
축하드립니다. 감사합니다. 사랑합니다.
70 years with KBS World Radio, 70 years of Global Korea. KBS World Radio brings Korea to you wherever you are.
Hello, it's Friday the 17th of March, and welcome to Korea 24. I'm your host, Kwon Jang-ho. President Yoon Suk-yeol expressed optimism for South Korea-Japan ties as he met leading politicians and business figures on his second day in Tokyo. This comes after his summit with Prime Minister Fumio Kishida on Thursday. We'll have more on his trip for a news briefing shortly, and then we'll also discuss how the outcomes from the summit will impact future Seoul-Tokyo relations for our in-depth today. And then coming up later for Movie Spotlight, we review a local drama about female friendship called Soulmate, and we look back at this year's Oscars. Let's begin Korea 24. President Yoon Suk-yeol said on Friday that Seoul and Tokyo should work together to respond to various global issues, including supply chains, climate change, cutting-edge science and technology, and economic security. This comes on day two of President Yoon's trip to Tokyo. Our KBS World Radio news editor Koo Hee-jin joins us in the studio now to update us on the latest from this visit, as well as our other headlines of the day. Hee-jin, hello.
Hello, Jang-ho.
So first, to wrap up the events from yesterday, after President Yoon and Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida held their summit, we heard that they knocked back a pint or two after hours at a 128-year-old bar last night in a sign of renewed friendship. And then the next day, today, Yoon shared his vision of economic cooperation with business leaders from both countries attending a joint conference. So Hee-jin, can you tell us more? What else did he say?
Well, during the South Korea-Japan Business Roundtable in Tokyo, held at the hall of the Japanese Business Federation, also known as Keidanren, Yoon stressed the need for bilateral cooperation on future high-tech industries, including the digital transformation, semiconductors, batteries and electric vehicles. Citing the agreement reached the previous day between Keidanren and the Federation of Korean Industries on the creation of funds to promote future partnerships, Yoon said the expansion of mutual understanding and cooperation by future generations will strengthen bilateral ties. The roundtable was attended by 12 guests from South Korea, including the heads of Samsung Electronics, SK Group, Hyundai Motors and LG Group, who were joined by 11 from Japan. Prime Minister Fumio Kishida was not on hand for the event. Thursday's gathering was the first meeting of business people from two countries attended by a South Korean president in 14 years and the first to see the participation of South Korea's top four business groups in some 20 years.
The president also encouraged the younger generation of Japan to boost exchanges and cooperation with their South Korean counterparts during a visit to Keio University in Tokyo. Can you tell us more?
Well, in a lecture in front of some 200 students at the school on the second and last day of his visit, Yoon said that if the two countries' youths hold active exchanges, it will not take long to tangibly feel the effects of that trust and friendship. Yoon said it is extremely important that the two countries, which share universal values, work together to improve and develop their relationship for their common interests, as well as for world peace and prosperity. Yoon said that South Korea and Japan share a similar culture and public sentiment rarely seen worldwide and are known for their vibrant personnel exchanges. Also referring to the joint declaration of 1998 by then President Kim Dae-jung and Japanese Prime Minister Keizo Obuchi, Yoon said that the pact had emphasized the 1,500-year-long bilateral history of exchanges and cooperation must not be made meaningless due to 50 years of unfortunate history, and stressed that the younger generations are the future of the two neighboring countries.
Reactions on the summit from rival political parties were starkly different. Main opposition Democratic Party leader Lee Jae-myung lambasted the administration for choosing to willingly become quote-unquote Japan's puppet. He also called the summit the most shameful and pitiful moment in the nation's diplomatic history. On the other hand, the People Power Party expressed hope for normalized bilateral ties. Can you elaborate on the reactions?
Well, at a Supreme Council meeting on Friday, DP's Lee Jae-myung noted the lack of an apology or regret on the part of Japan. He accused the administration of trading the nation's self-respect and the victims' rights and historical justice for a dish of omelette with fried rice, or omuraisu, that the two leaders shared after the summit. Meanwhile, PPP floor leader Chu Ho-young said he hopes normalized ties will provide new opportunities to the local economy and help revitalize it with Tokyo's lifting of export curbs against South Korea. Chu said North Korea's launch of an intercontinental ballistic missile around the time of Yoon's Japan visit further confirms the necessity and urgency of enhancing military cooperation with Tokyo and Washington.
Meanwhile, Japanese media are reporting that Prime Minister Fumio Kishida has expressed his intent to invite South Korea to the Group of Seven Leaders Summit in the Japanese city of Hiroshima in May. So what more do we know?
Well, citing an unnamed Japanese government official on Friday, Japan's Kyodo News and said Kishida made the remark during Thursday's summit with President Yoon in Tokyo. Japan's public broadcaster NHK also said Tokyo was fine-tuning the details of that invitation as part of efforts to improve ties with Seoul. As the year's G7 chair, Japan has reportedly considered inviting South Korea to reinforce solidarity with countries with shared values in response to North Korea's nuclear and missile provocations, China's bolstered hegemony, and the Russian invasion of Ukraine. On Thursday, Yoon and Kishida agreed to improve bilateral relations, encompassing areas of security, diplomacy, and the economy, as well as to restore a consultative body aimed at strengthening two-way cooperation.
North Korea's state media has reported on the regime's latest missile launch. Leader Kim Jong-un reportedly supervised the launch of what it claimed was a Hwasong-17 intercontinental ballistic missile on Thursday. He was also once again accompanied by his daughter, Jue. Can you tell us more?
Well, North Korea's official Korean Central News Agency said on Friday that the ICBM was test-fired the previous day in response to the instability of the security environment on the Korean Peninsula, resulting from the provocative and aggressive large-scale war drills conducted by the US and South Korea. The North claimed that the launch had no negative impact on the neighboring countries, adding that it confirmed the war readiness of the ICBM unit. Kim reportedly expressed great satisfaction with the test firing and stressed the need to strengthen the country's nuclear war deterrence to a degree that it cannot be dismantled. He also hinted that Pyongyang will continue its military actions in response to the South Korea-US combined military exercises, saying that the North will make its enemies realize that they will face an irreversible threat at a serious level.
In other news, prosecutors and lawyers representing main opposition Democratic Party Chairman Lee Jae-myung exchanged arguments in court on Friday over Lee's claim that he did not know a deceased former official of a municipal development firm involved in the Daejangdong land development scandal. Can you update us on this situation as well?
Well, in a hearing on Lee's trial on election law violation charges held at the Seoul Central District Court, the prosecution refuted claims made by Lee's legal representatives one after the other. They said that Lee played golf with Kim Moon-gi and also bestowed a citation on him, noting such shared experiences are certainly memorable. Lee's lawyer said the defendant does not clearly remember with whom he played golf, and photos and videos of Lee and Kim taken together in Australia show they never make eye contact, which sheds light on their bare acquaintance. Lee's charges stem from a televised interview in 2021 in which he denied being acquainted with Kim, the former head of Seongnam Development Corporation's project development team during his term as Seongnam mayor. Kim was found dead the day before he was set to appear for questioning in the Daejangdong scandal investigation.
We wrap it up there for our news briefing today. Thank you for those updates.
Thank you.
President Yoon Suk-yeol has wrapped up his two-day trip to Japan after meeting Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida on Thursday. It marked the first visit by a Korean president for a bilateral summit in 12 years, and it's been hailed by the two leaders as a resumption of the so-called shuttle diplomacy between the two countries. Other outcomes include Tokyo lifting its export restrictions on three critical semiconductor materials to South Korea, the complete normalization of the military information sharing pact called JISOMIA, and an agreement to discuss putting Korea back on Japan's trade whitelist. But missing was a renewed apology from Japan for the wartime forced labor issue or a pledge to contribute to the compensation fund set up by Seoul. To look back on the trip, we have two guests joining us on the line now. First, we have Dr. Bong Young-sik, Research Fellow at the Yonsei Institute for North Korean Studies. Dr. Bong, hello.
Hello.
We also have Brad Glosserman, the Deputy Director and Visiting Professor at the Center for Rulemaking Strategies at Tama University. Professor Glosserman, thank you for connecting with us today as well.
Always a pleasure to talk to you.
Let me first get both of your quick overall assessments of the summit between Yoon and Kishida yesterday. Professor Glosserman, let me start with you.
I thought it was a very good meeting. I'm very pleased with the results. I think you summarized the outcomes very well. I'd like to have seen, I think, you know, the shortcomings that you mentioned. It would be nice to have seen Japan go a little further, contribute to the fund, to offer another apology. But I think we've laid a very, very firm foundation. And frankly, I put it on Japan to provide a little more energy and initiative to help build the public support in South Korea. That's really going to be vital and absolutely essential if this agreement is going to survive this administration and the next in South Korea.
Hmm. Dr. Bong, what about you? Do you think the two leaders got what they wanted from the meeting?
Well, let me just cite a line from Shakespeare's Hamlet to sound cruel. Hamlet said that there is nothing either good or bad, but thinking makes so. So it's a good start if you're going to get the right result with time, but it will be recorded as a bad, you know, agreement if Yoon Suk-yeol government is not going to produce kind of result that is satisfactory to South Korean public.
Mm. Right, so it's interesting. You've both mentioned the support from the Korean public down the line, but you've both also said that it's a good start, a good foundation. Now, during a joint press conference after the summit, Yoon declared a complete normalization of the military intelligence sharing pact, or JISOMIA, to give its full name, it's the General Security of Military Information Agreement. This pact has not been functioning at full capacity since 2019, when tensions between the two nations reached its peak over the Korean Supreme Court rulings ordering Japanese firms to compensate Korean victims of wartime forced labor. Dr. Bong, how significant is the restoration of GSOMIA, especially amid North Korea's growing missile and nuclear threats?
Well, you already gave us the right answer. Because of the escalation of threats from North Korea with its more sophisticated missile technologies and nuclear weapon systems, as well as other means of military threats, South Korea and the United States, as well as Japan, would need to augment their own defensive capability individually and collectively. So in that context, the restoration of GSOMIA is a very positive development.
Mm. And Professor Glossman, how important do you think it was for the two countries to normalize this intelligence sharing pact?
Well, first, I'm not sure what normalize means other than perhaps use it to its full potential. Except, I mean, GSOMIA, to be very honest, is a very bland, very pro forma agreement. It really just sort of lays out what are the specifications for trading documents. You know, what size print will they be? I mean, it's really very bland. It doesn't go to the real important issue, which is the political will, both to share meaningful information, in other words, the stuff that's going to matter in the case of a crisis, and then, more importantly, the larger set of questions, which is the readiness to cooperate to address the threats that the two and three countries face. So, I mean, it's a box-ticking exercise, to be a little cynical and, I think, realistic about it, to be very honest. It's a symbol of the readiness to move on, but it alone itself doesn't do a great deal. What really has to happen is that the countries have got to start really working together bilaterally and trilaterally to start addressing the ever more serious threats posed by North Korea and, I think, frankly, by China as well.
Well, the logic of the reasoning during the Moon Jae-in government in response to the imposition of export control by the Abe administration in response to the Korean Supreme Court's ruling in favor of the plaintiffs in 2018. Well, Moon Jae-in government hoped that a threat to walk away from GSOMIA would move Washington, because Washington desperately wanted to keep security cooperation with both South Korea and Japan.
Mm.
Then with this threat, Washington will put pressure on the Abe administration to do something that would...
the Kishida administration.
To Moon Jae-in government of South Korea. But it basically backfired.
Oh, right. The previous administration, you mean?
Right.
So with that all in mind then, so GSOMIA, although as Professor Glossman has mentioned, it's not just the GSOMIA itself, but what else it represents. With that in mind, Professor Glossman, what else from the summit yesterday caught your eye that is a positive step, at least for now?
Well, you outlined it very well. I mean, I think the agreement to drop the export controls on the chemicals is an important, you know, show of intent. You know, it takes us away from the petty tit for tat and removes some of the underbrush of tension, if you will. The decision to resume the shuttle diplomacy. I mean, the idea that the leaders of the two countries haven't met like this in 12 years is frankly absurd, given the changes in the regional security environment, given their proximity. I mean, you know, I'm an idealist, but I would think that you'd be able to have a relationship where every couple of months, at least, you know, literally every 2 months, one of them hops on a plane and the two of them go to a hot spring or some little place, have a meeting for a couple of hours and pop back. I mean, there's certainly nothing that would prevent, given their closeness and given the issues and the shared concerns, nothing that would prevent them from having those conversations. And I think it would do the countries well. I mean, the bottom line for me, as we've talked about over so many conversations, is really the demonstration to the two publics of the need for them to work together and to see each other as partners. And I think the example has got to come from the top.
Now, the summit comes after the Yoon Suk-yeol government announced its plan to compensate victims of Japan's wartime forced labor through a fund using domestic corporate donations. But this has proven to be unpopular with the general public here in Korea. And also the three surviving victims from the related lawsuits have rejected the deal. However, during the press conference, Yoon hinted that South Korea will not exercise its right to indemnity on the issue of Japan's wartime forced labor. And Kishida did not mention any reciprocal measures to the forced labor issue either. There was also no direct apology from Kishida. This has been met with fierce criticism from Yoon's opponents, describing it as a shameful submission to Japan. Professor Glossman, how significant could the public backlash be for the future relations between the two countries? Some observers have said that the attempts at improved South Korea-Japan relations may falter if Japan does not significantly offer reciprocal steps on this issue.
I agree completely. Japan, I've long insisted that when this problem first started, I would put much of the blame for the deterioration of relations at the feet of the Moon administration. That may not be popular in South Korea, but I think it's a reasonable assessment. Since President Yoon has taken office, I've shifted, and I think that the problem has been in Tokyo, which has just moved too slow. And I think that looking, objectively at what was agreed and what has transpired in the last couple of weeks, is that Japan has been, gifted with some extraordinary steps by a very courageous South Korean president, and it needs to do, and he's paying a political price for that. And that's what Japan has always demanded of its counterpart. And I think that Japan needs to step up. And I'm frankly a little disappointed that a statement wasn't offered by Kishida, as you said, an apology. And Japan has apologized many times, but there's nothing wrong with doing it again. And it would have been nice to have seen some contributions for Japanese companies other than merely from the Keidan Ren to that fund. I think there were ways to do that would have been that would not have compromised the legal position that Japan has maintained. And I think that Japan has got to do more to, again, as I said, demonstrate its fidelity, that it's a good partner, and that South Korea can feel happy and proud about the agreement that it's reached. And frankly, I'm very concerned that Japan is going to fuel precisely the backlash that you identified unless it does more.
I have a question for Professor Glossman what's going to happen after the election in April? Will Kishida administration and the LDP change their attitude in a more positive way?
That's a really good question. I mean, right now Kishida himself does not have very high opinion ratings. And,
right.
And by the way, what Professor Boone is referring to is referring to are these local elections that'll be in April. I mean, the biggest issue I think is always of domestic politics, but as well as the fact that Kishida will be hosting the G7 in Hiroshima. And again, that would be a great opportunity to bring President Yoon over and to demonstrate the relationship and bring South Korea into those discussions. I think it would be a very valuable contribution.
Dr. Wong,
Yes.
Dr. Wong, if I could go back to asking the questions.
Mm-hmm.
Professor Glossman has called President Yoon's moves courageous. But what do you make of the criticism that he's also been getting that perhaps Korea failed to get something significant from Japan on the forced labor issue and is essentially sweeping this issue under the rug, and that this could come back to haunt bilateral relations in the future, especially if Japan does not offer reciprocal steps further down the line?
I give a credit to President Yoon Sung-yeol for keeping his own words, that buck stops here, that he's going to assume all the responsibilities, good or bad, as a president who made a decision. Now, the attitude is quite different from the attitude demonstrated by his predecessors. In similar cases in the past, not present themselves, but like foreign ministers or prime ministers would be the sacrificial lambs in attempt to appease the public anger. So in that regard, I give a credit to President Yoon Sung-yeol being very forthright and forthcoming.
Mm.
Having said that, there is a clear challenge to the regime with this decision, because the way President Yoon Sung-yeol reached this decision is strikingly similar to the way previous Moon Jae-in government dealing with Kim Jong-un regime of North Korea, like giving unconditional trust in Kim Jong-un leadership, that Kim Jong-un leadership has a genuine commitment to denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula without providing any solid evidence to prove the belief. And the premise of the Moon Jae-in government's open policy toward North Korea was premised upon the argument that if we are magnanimous and proactive toward the Kim Jong-un regime of North Korea, then there will be due reciprocation by North Korea in the form of inter-Korean economic cooperation and the reduction of nuclear weapons and missiles. And conservative politicians in South Korea used to criticize such an engagement approach taken by Moon Jae-in government toward Kim Jong-un regime of North Korea. And now the same framework is being used by the opponents and critics of the Yoon Jae-in government and the ruling party, you know, PPP. So how to deal with this criticism? There's no shortcut, but you have to produce a result. You have to produce the result that although your approach was very risky, huge gamble, but it somehow led to the positive outcomes.
Right, then, looking ahead, do you think there could be positive outcomes coming down the road? How do you think relations between the two countries will develop going forward now?
The first critical test is whether the two defendant Japanese corporations will take any type of part in the foundations. Then it will be a very concrete sign. They will be very satisfactory to the South Korean public. But it is questionable whether such a change is going to take place or not. And the dilemma for Yoon Suk-yeol government is that the expected benefits of the restoration of the security cooperation with Japan, like GSOMIA, is not really tangible. It is not easy to be felt by South Korean public because security or deterrence against North Korean military threat cannot be demonstrated easily and visibly to the South Korean public with a very clean and obvious scorecard. So it will be very challenging for the Yoon Suk-yeol government to show South Korean public that, see, we are getting tangible benefit from this difficult yet necessary decision.
Professor Glossman, what about you? What do you see for the road ahead for the two countries?
Well, I agree with Professor Wong's logic in terms of showing the concrete outcomes and the advantages. So, you know, seeing President Yoon at the G7 standing next to Kishida and being shown that he's got the status and that he's seen as a valuable partner, I think similar, you know, outcomes that come from their bilateral shuttle summitry would be a nice touch. If we can see some outcomes from the economic discussions, or you know, from the trade talks that do with the export controls. I mean, you know, one of the things that hasn't been mentioned, but I'm not certain, but I'm almost certain was linked, was the decision to offer President Yoon the state dinner in the White House in April was linked. You know, you noticed that announcement came about a day or so after the announcement of his readiness. So, I mean, I think you'll see some tangibles. Maybe you'll see them in economic talks in regard to cooperation agreements that deal with the two countries, because there was an agreement now for National Security Council economic consultations to go between the two countries. So, I mean, I think that's where we're going to have to look for that. The problem is that you're not going to see it linked explicitly to the agreement. What you're going to see are two partners working to advance their interests and coming up with, you know, steps forward. But tying it, you're not going to see the direct linkage to this particular agreement. So it's just a question of putting in a positive light the relationship and showing how important it is that Seoul and Tokyo work together on common concerns.
And finally, Dr. Bong, the U.S. has pushed for and welcomed efforts by South Korea and Japan to improve relations. How much do you think that has contributed to this summit and what was agreed? What does this do for South Korea-U.S. relations ahead of their summit next month as well?
Majority of South Korean public who may support Yoon Suk-yeol government's decision to open the bilateral relationship with Japan with this decision will not feel so comfortable to watch smiling faces of the, you know, president and the first lady during the state visit to Washington, D.C., because they may see that as an exchange for the giving up the legal rights of the victims of forced labor. So what President Yoon Suk-yeol needs to do is to show genuine attitude toward the victims and their families. As the president of South Korea, he should issue apology, like the way that the counterterrorism advisor during the Bush administration, Mr. Richard Clark, that during the testimony in 2004 that, you know, your government failed you. Those interested with protecting you failed you, and I failed you. I ask your forgiveness. Something very personal, something that is genuine, gesture apology would, soften the public anger. Without that, how many big achievements the president's office may explain to the general public and the media after the state visit to Washington, the public will still remain very comfortable to acknowledge those achievements.
Okay, we will have to wrap it up there. We've been speaking to Dr. Pong Yong-shik from the Yonsei Institute for North Korean Studies and Professor Brad Glosserman from the Center for Rulemaking Strategies at Tama University in Tokyo. Thank you once again for your time today.
Very welcome.
Always a pleasure to talk to you and to hear Yong-shik's comments. Always insightful. Thank you.
Same here.
Welcome to the Korea 24 Stock and Forex Update. The benchmark Korea Composite Stock Price Index jumped 17.78 points, or 0.75% on Friday, to close the week at 2,395.69. The tech-heavy KOSDAQ also rose, gaining 15.41 points, or 1.97%, to close at 797.39. On the foreign exchange, the local currency strengthened 10.81 against the U.S. dollar, closing the day at 1,302.21.
You can check Korean stock and forex closings at world.kbs.co.kr.
Next up, it's Korea Trending, our daily segment where we take a look at some of the other news headlines that have been trending online. And for that, we have Walter Lee joining us in the studio today. Walter, hello. It's good to see you.
Oh, Chang-ho. It's always good to see you.
We are jumping straight into our stories today. So, Walter, what do you have for us first?
Okay, so the South Korean government is considering introducing conditional driver's licenses for seniors aged 65 or older as part of measures to reduce the number of traffic accidents. Now, ministries related to transport and safety as well as the National Police Agency discussed the possibility during a meeting on Thursday. Now, a government official said the measure aims to issue driver's licenses to elderly citizens on the condition that they don't drive at night or on expressways and drive no faster than a certain speed limit.
You said that this is to reduce the number of accidents. How many accidents involving elderly drivers are recorded in the country each year?
Well, according to the Korea Road Traffic Authority, the number of traffic accidents caused by such drivers has risen from 12.4% in 2017 to 15.7% in 2021. Also in 2021, some 2,900 people died from car accidents, and more than 24% of them were caused by drivers aged 65 or older. Now, that's over three times more than the deaths resulting from drunk driving. Now, with the growing number of Korea's elderly population, the number of people aged 65 or older who have a driver's license has seen an increase of 10.2% on average every year in the past 10 years.
Right, so this could be seen as another side effect of the aging population. I remember that we covered on our show in the past that there is a system in place where elderly drivers get incentives if they voluntarily hand in their driver's licenses, right?
Yeah, that's correct. So since 2018, the government introduced such a system to reduce traffic accidents and for the sake of the elderly driver's safety. However, according to the National Police Agency, out of nearly 4.4 million drivers aged 65 or older, only 2.6% handed in their licenses last year. Now, the rate was particularly low in farming and fishing communities where public transport is not as easily accessible compared to, obviously, large cities.
Right, so seeing this plan hasn't been particularly effective, the government is looking to step up with this new measure. We'll see if it does become a more concrete plan in the future. Let's move on to our second story. What do you have for us?
So an environmental geology expert has warned that the Korean Peninsula could see an earthquake of magnitude 5 in the next 2 to 3 years, given the movements of the tectonic plates. Bugyeong National University professor Kim Yong-seok unveiled the assessment on Thursday during an event organized by the Korean Federation of Science and Technology Societies. Now, the theme of the event was Turkey earthquake, is the Korean Peninsula safe? Kim said results of recent studies conducted here at home found that the peninsula could see seismic activity from a clash between the Pacific plate and the Eurasian plate.
Right, the latest disaster in Turkey was also due to the clash of two tectonic plates, right?
Yeah, so the Arabia and Anatolia plates. So most regions that witnesses major quakes, like the one in Turkey suffered, sits at the crossroads of the tectonic plates. Now, a senior researcher at the Korea Institute of Geoscience and Mineral Resources said at Thursday's discussion that the Korean Peninsula has not seen many major earthquakes, given that it is located far from where two or more plates meet. However, the researcher was quick to add that there is still the possibility that such disasters could rattle South Korean regions in the Seoul metro area. He stressed that the need for the public to be aware that small or mid-sized quakes could also cause damage. He cited that when looking at history, the peninsula was affected by seismic activity that occurred in surrounding tectonic plates. One example given was the 15th and 16th centuries, when China's far eastern regions and Japan's southwestern areas saw many quakes.
Yes, it is a concern, because in countries where there are frequent quakes, they are better prepared with buildings and architecture to better withstand such as shakes. So if a significant quake were to hit Korea, could be quite devastating. Seems unlikely, but this expert is warning that it could happen.
Mm.
Okay, let's move on to our second story. What do you have for us?
Yeah, so South Korean pianist Cho Songjin's album, The Handle Project, has topped the Billboard's traditional classic albums chart. Now, the album, which Cho released last month via the German classical music record label Deutsche Grammophon, debuted at number one in the weekly chart, which was released on Thursday. Now, The Handle Project is Cho's sixth album to be released by the German label, with the last being Chopin Piano Concerto No. 2 in the Scherzi, released some 2 years ago.
Okay, so this is quite the feat. Can you tell us more about this album then? I understand that it also contains a work by Brahms.
Yes, so The Handle Project consists of three of Cho's favourite suites from Handel's first collection of keyboard suites, which were originally published in London in 1720. And yes, as you mentioned, the album also contains Brahms' virtuosic variations of Fugue on a theme by Handel, based on one movement from suite number 3. Now, regarding the album, Cho said that for him, Handel's music comes directly from the heart, and described Brahms' variations as being the best variations that have ever been written.
And I believe that Cho is not the first Korean pianist to top this weekly chart, right?
Yeah, he's not. So Im Hyun-jong topped the chart with her debut album, Complete Beethoven Piano Sonatas, in 2012. And Sonu Yeg-won came in number one with Cliburn Gold 2017, 15th Van Cliburn International Piano Competition.
Okay, we'll wrap it up there for today's Korea Trending. Thank you for those stories, and we'll see you next time.
See you next time.
Next up, it's Movie Spotlight, our weekly segment reviewing the latest cinematic releases at the Korean box office and online. And we do that with the help of our panel of film critics. This week we have Jason Beshevace. Jason, hello. It's good to see you.
Hello, Jaya. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. And we also have Darcy Paquette with us as well. Hello, Darcy.
Happy to be here.
Okay, so today we'll just be reviewing one film and then having a bit of a Oscars wrap-up as well, so a little different from usual. This week, the first film we have, it's a local release. It's called Soulmate in both Korean and English. It features the popular star Kim Dami and Chun Sun-hee, and it's a film about female friendship. The film opened in theatres on Wednesday and currently sits second at the box office. So, Jason, can you start us off for us? Can you introduce this film?
Yeah, sure. It's basically a film. I mean, it's a really good film. It follows two central characters, two girls. We're introduced to one of the girls, played by Kim Dami, a young woman. And then it basically, over the course of the film, we get to learn about the relationship between these two girls. And it flashes back to Jeju Island in 1998. And we, as viewers, learn more about them. They're extremely close. But things happen that basically mean they essentially drift apart. They're also quite different characters as well. One of them is really outgoing, quite independent. This is a character played by Kim Dami. And then the character played by John Sunny, she's a little bit more kind of introverted. She doesn't like getting on planes. She doesn't want to travel. Something happens because there's also a guy in the mix and there's a misunderstanding. And it's essentially a film about, it's a coming of age film. And it's directed by Min Yong-gun, who previously made the indie film Re-Encounter that was really well received in Busan 2010. So this is his commercial debut. Kim Dami, she's very much at the center of this film. She is a terrific actress. I'm sure listeners will be familiar with some of her work. Itaewon Class, of course, and The Witch Part 1, which really kind of put her in the spotlight. So in terms of the narrative, that's pretty much all you need to know.
Darcy, I understand the film is actually a remake of a popular Chinese film.
Yeah, I mean, the original film is quite interesting as well, and it has an interesting backstory. There's an actor-director from Hong Kong named Derek Tsang, and you know, he made this movie Soulmate in 2016, which was based on a novel by a Chinese writer, Annie Baobei. And it stars the actresses Zhao Dongyu and Sandra Ma. And I mean, one of the memorable things about this film, it was really well received. It did well at the box office, and then it received a bunch of nominations at the Golden Horse Awards, which are kind of the biggest awards for Chinese language cinema. It's based in Taiwan. And the jury couldn't decide which one to give the best actress prize to, and so gave it to both of them.
Wow. Okay.
I mean, it tells you something about the film because, you know, their roles are so intertwined and the performances are so interlinked that, you know, to give it to one and not the other just seems wrong. And so that was, that was the dynamic on that original film. The director and the actress, Zhao Dongyu, went on to make a movie, Better Days, which we reviewed on this show several years ago. Mm. That was also a tremendous hit. It's a very high-profile film in the Chinese-speaking world, and so it's interesting that we get this Korean version of it. Remakes are a real trend in Korean cinema these days. We're seeing a lot of them, and there are a number of different reasons for that. You know, in some ways, it may give filmmakers also a chance to make the kind of story that wouldn't get financed otherwise. I'm not sure if you took this story to big investors and said,
right,
you know, I want to make a film about, you know, this long-term friendship between two women. They might kind of show you the door. But yeah, in this case, you know, right, it's based on a very successful film.
Right, so Jason, you've given it away already a little bit, but you said it's a good film, right?
Yeah, I really liked it, actually. In terms of the structure, it's very similar to the original film. But actually, each scene, or a lot of the scenes, just play out quite differently. And so it's quite subtle in the way it's different, and I really admire that. I really like the way Korean directors approach remakes. We saw that with Confession last year as well, Ditto, and Remember, of course. There's been a long tradition, there's Door Lock, of all these films that have actually kind of, they've breathed new life into to this kind of original material and done something a little bit new. And I think that's also true here. They're both distinctive films, sure, structurally very, very similar, but at the same time, I think that they're also quite different. I don't know if Darcy agrees with me on that, but certainly very well crafted. It's beautiful to look at. The acting's terrific. I love the two leads. And I really liked it. I was really engaged. It's quite long, but actually it kind of races by. Two really interesting female characters. We don't get to see that a lot these days, although we are seeing more of it, but certainly not enough, you know, of these female-centered films. And this, I think, really does shed light on some of the issues facing women. And I give it my thumbs up.
Okay, so Jason there, thumbs up. Darcy, what about you?
Yeah, I liked it as well. I like that the film is able just to kind of focus on a fairly simple story. I mean, it has some twists and turns, but, a lot of movies kind of feel this obligation to really try to, you know, twist up the story and make these surprises and to entertain you. And sometimes, you know, just feeling, you can feel the film trying to be really entertaining and to tell a complicated and exciting story. And films don't always need that. Sometimes you can just have like a really simple story about two people.
Right.
And this film, because it does just focus on that, I think we do go kind of deeper into their relationship. And yeah, I really enjoyed it as well.
Right, and how do you compare it to the original as well?
Well, I don't know. The original was really, really good too. So.
Yeah, they're both good films. I saw them both this week, actually, on the same day.
And right,
they're both very good, actually. I'm not sure which one I prefer. I think just because the original is so popular in Korea, I think, you know, there will be those who will say whether the original is better. But actually, I think, like I said earlier, they're both quite unique in their own way. And that's what I liked about both of them.
So generally, a positive review from both our critics for Soulmate, which is out now in Korean cinemas. Now, for the second part of our segment, we wanted to briefly look back at the Oscars, which took place last Sunday. Everything, Everywhere, All at Once took home almost all of the top awards, including Best Picture, Best Director, Best Actress, Best Supporting Actor, and Best Supporting Actress. Particularly notable among those winners was Michelle Yeoh, who became the first Asian woman ever to win Best Actress. So, Dusty, any thoughts on the Oscars as a whole? How did you rate it as an event?
Well, I think, first of all, I mean, I guess the first thing to say is that it felt comparatively normal for the first time in a long while. Mm. And, you know, after Parasite won in 2020, you know, the pandemic just kind of upended the ceremony and, you know, they tried to cope with it in different ways. And, you know, they brought in Steven Soderbergh that year to try to, you know, do something different with the Oscars. And it got mixed reception. And last year we thought we were returning to normal. And then Will Smith strode on stage.
Right.
And it's kind of upstaged the whole event. And so, yeah, I mean, this year I think people really appreciated the fact that it was kind of a familiar, traditional sort of Oscars. There were no really unexpected, you know, shocking developments. The only thing that went over really badly was the decision to replace the red carpet with a champagne-colored carpet.
Yeah, that was really weird.
Which,
I don't know what it is.
You know, in all the pictures, it looks like kind of dirty office carpeting or something. And all the actors, their dresses are all washed out. And it,
so right, okay. So
universal ban on the champagne carpet.
But. Well, if that's the biggest criticism, I guess it was a fairly successful event this year then. But perhaps they will bring back the red carpet next year. Jason, Everything, Everywhere, All at Once. It's quite extraordinary, the number of awards it won. How significant was it to you, do you think, though? Because it is significant in so many ways, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Certainly for Asian representation. The fact, actually, also, that it's a genre movie, kind of similar to Parasite. And it premiered at South by Southwest Festival, like, almost a year before. Practically, yeah, a whole year before the festival. So been around a while. A kind of a wacky movie, entertaining film. This is not normally the movie that kind of voters go for. And so it's significant for that. And I think in some ways it kind of followed the success of Parasite. I think they really, I mean, you just look at the, you know, the entire cast and directors. So the directors are really young. And I think it was reflecting, I think perhaps a shift in the Academy, in the films they vote for. Mm. And I think the wider changes in the film industry, sure. I mean, Netflix have had their moment and they still did pretty well. All Quiet on the Western Front did very well in the craft categories. They still have yet to win Best Picture. And last year, of course, it was Coda with Apple. But I think, you know, if we have time, we'll talk about A24. I think we're seeing these smaller studios doing very well at the Oscars. Neon is another one with Parasite. So I think it was a very well-received ceremony, as Darcy mentioned, you know, back to normal. But yeah, I mean, Everything, Everywhere, All at Once is not a normal film. It's not a conventional movie. It's a very good film. But I think it's taking the Academy in a really interesting direction, and I'm up for that. And I think a lot of people are too.
Yeah, it's a big win for relatively small independent film, right? As you said, as Jason noted, this is another film by the distributor A24 as well, which has really been making waves in recent years. And in fact, at this year's Oscars as well, The Whale was also from A24
yep.
as
yes.
well. And the best actor in that film went to, the best actor award went to Brendan Fraser in that film as well. What do you think it says about filmmaking in the US these days?
Well, I mean, it is very different than it used to be because, you know, the studios used to have these specialty divisions and it was sort of like they'd make their major films and then they'd have these divisions that would focus on, you know, kind of I don't know, quality entertainment, or, you know, the kind of films that would get recognized at the Oscars. And, you know, I think probably it was, you know, Netflix and OTT coming in that kind of changed a lot of things. In general, you know, the audience has been changing and tastes have been changing. And, you know, not many people have known really what is going to work in the new, you know, the new era. And and A24, I get, you know, I'm not sure if they knew from the beginning that they would be able to do this, but they really kind of stepped into a space that where there was an opening. And, you know, they have great relationships with all the directors that they work with. Everybody admires A24 and wants to work with them. And so in that sense, they're able to really turn out some interesting films. And, you know, it's been a while since we've had a company that has kind of its own brand that people trust. And I think there are a lot of viewers who, you know, if there's a new A24 film, even if they don't know the director, or they don't know very much about it, they're kind of interested to see it just because the studio has such a good reputation. So that's great to see, and I hope that they continue making many, many films in the future.
Yes, well, it was certainly an Oscars to remember for all of the right reasons this year. Okay, that is where we're going to have to end it today. Jason, Darcy, thank you as always for your reviews and thoughts as always, and we'll see you again next time.
Yeah, have a great weekend.
Take care.
We wrap up the week as usual with our closing Friday segment next week from Seoul. And to tell us what's coming up in the week ahead, our staff editor Richard Larkin joins us in the studio now. Richard, hello, it's good to see you.
Hello, good to see you too.
Okay, so what's the first thing we should look out for next week?
I believe we have previously mentioned the first important news for next week on the show. The South Korean government has decided to lift one of the country's last remaining COVID-19 quarantine rules by ending the indoor mask mandate on public transit from next Monday. Masks will also not be required for pharmacies located inside large-scale facilities, such as retail stores or train stations. However, the rule is still in place for regular pharmacies, hospitals, and high-risk facilities, including nursing homes. Vice Interior Minister Han Chang-sub announced the decision in the government meeting on COVID-19 responses on Wednesday. It came amid a 38% drop in daily infections since a general easing of the mandate on January 30th.
Right, so masks will no longer be mandatory for subways and buses starting Monday, but as we saw when the indoor mask mandate was lifted, I suspect we will likely see many people continuing to wear masks in Korea for the time being. Let's move on. What's the next thing we should look out for next week?
From Monday, travellers will be able to cross between South Korea and China by sea for the first time in 3 years. This comes as a suspension of operation due to the COVID-19 pandemic has come to an end. The Ministry of Oceans and Fisheries announced earlier this week that passenger transport on 15 international routes linking South Korea's Incheon, Pyeongtaek and Gunsan ports with 11 Chinese ports will resume. It is worth noting, however, that the actual resumption of service may take time as preparations are not expected to be completed immediately.
I see. So another pandemic-related measure coming to an end. Let's look at one more. What else is happening?
The South Korean men's national football team will host their first match with the new head coach, Jurgen Klinsmann. The Daegu Warriors will go up against Colombia next Friday in Ulsan, some 310 kilometers southeast of Seoul. South Korea are currently 25th in the FIFA World Rankings, 8 spots below Colombia. But they do have a good record against the South American nation, with 4 wins, 2 draws and 1 loss. Earlier this week, the team roster was announced, and only 2 players who went to the World Cup in Qatar were not chosen. They are defenders Yoon Jong-gyu and Hong Chul, who are out because of injuries. Meanwhile, Suwon Samson Blue Wings defender Lee Gi-jae and Celtic forward Oh Hyun-gyu were added to the roster. To prepare for the upcoming friendly, the coaching staff and players will take part in a training camp at the National Football Centre in Paju on Monday.
Yes, and we'll have a fuller preview on our sports roundup segment on Monday. Meanwhile, that's all the time we have for next week from Seoul. Richard, thank you for those previews and we'll see you next week.
Thank you. Have a nice weekend.
And that's our show for today. Join us again on Monday for all of the latest from Korea. Till then, we hope you have a great weekend. I've been your host, Kwon Jang-woo, and thank you, as always, for listening. Goodbye.